Let's do this.
Start the game already!
Happy fucking anniversary.
Indeed. It is a nutty anniversary. Release the Kraken.
It's actually, like, I looked at the date on our first episode and it was May 1st. So we missed it by a month.
Oh, all right. Well, that's fine. I mean, our studio scheduler is really sleeping on the job. We should probably... Oh, yeah, that's right. We don't have one.
Anybody that wants to functionally be a unpaid intern for the next year, hit us up.
Yeah, that's right. If you would like to get paid nothing, it comes with a raise of 20% after 3 months. I wonder if, considering our pre-episode conversation, we should talk about nerds and their propensity, drive, compulsion to tinker with things that work. Because there is no doubt that there's merit in trying to fix things that are broken, but it takes a special kind of nerd to look at something and go, you know what, this works fine. I should fix it.
I'm not sure I've had enough to drink for that conversation. Give me a second here. What do you got on the go?
I have the Kraken. So I've got spiced rum and mixing it with Pepsi that I made myself with a machine that is probably 90% the same price as just buying it off the shelf.
Like SodaStream kind of stuff?
Exactly that.
Hmm.
Other carbonation vehicles are available.
It is summertime-ish.
Is that a Rattler?
It is a Rattler. Waterloo Grapefruit Rattler.
That's good stuff. Do you know how Rattler was invented?
I do not.
So there was a bicycle race, and I can't remember whether it was in Germany or whether it was in France, but it was definitely earlier than the Tour de France. This is another thing we should probably talk about, is how nerds tend to hang on to information absolutely useless. And it was a bicycle race, and they stopped in at this bar for a break or like a rest stop or whatever. And the barkeep did not have enough beer for everyone. So basically cut the beer with grapefruit juice. Everybody loved it. And then he started serving it as a regular drink.
Hmm.
Yeah. Useless information. And now you know.
And knowing's half the battle.
Pork chop sandwiches.
All right, so you've been fixing something that wasn't broken.
Yes. Well, it was, to be fair, last week it was kind of broken, and that was my motivation because I listened to last week's episode and went, either Shane has done a thing where he's edited my voice to make me sound really bad, or I just sound really bad. And I mean, I was tinkering around with a new microphone, new DAC, new stack of things that my voice goes through. And I know almost nothing about that kind of stuff. I know just enough to be dangerous. And I tweaked my voice until it sounded like crap, thinking that it sounded good. It didn't sound good. And I'm sorry.
So you tweaked it some more. We'll see what it sounds like when we get around to editing. I blame it on Don King's scalp job there.
I do really find it amusing that I am talking into the ghost of Don King's hairpiece.
I was talking to Ian about that last week. He found it amusing. I referred to it as like a dead cat muff, and he's like, I have no idea what that is. I do. I had to send the Google pictures.
It's a merkin.
So what have you been up to besides playing too much golf?
Playing too much golf. Although I do have to say, I want to tell a story because I took a lesson with our local pro. Shout out to Drew, our local pro, who is a genius. And it was a little bit of the spark of me giving you an apology for being a really, really bad tech support customer. Because especially as we get older, right, we have these sort of fixed ideas in our mind, and we know, like, I know just enough about technical things to often go and find my own answers, right? I'm not super efficient about it. I'm not always super accurate about it, but I can generally get the job done. And it's sort of the same thing with my golf swing. And I was having some trouble, so I booked a lesson, and you know, like he took a look at my swing and said, okay, we'll take a couple of sort of, you know, warm up shots and then I'll take some video and we'll see what's what. And I took a couple of warm up shots and I was like, okay, I'm hitting it well today, because I was having serious problems the previous couple of days. And he said, all right, I'm going to take some video, but honestly, I'm not sure what I can help you with. Like, it's a pretty good looking swing, which I don't know if he was saying that just to pump my tires or if it was it made me feel good anyway. Because I've been playing this game for 30 years, right? Semi-seriously for 20 of them. So I kind of should be, not bad. And he took some video and he's like, all right, well, let's look at it. And he sort of goes through, he's literally just filming it on an iPhone. Cameras have come so far. And he's going sort of frame by frame and he's like, what's good? Oh, okay, I see, right here. And there was just like one little thing. And he said, what's happening is it like you're pausing right here instead of, you know, just following through. So he gave me a drill and literally I hit two shots using this drill. And then suddenly everything was just click. Wow. Like amazing. And I don't know if that's a common experience with lots of things, but it seems to me that there's lots of stuff that we sort of take for granted that we know how to do until someone who is really good at instruction or really good at teaching, right? Who can come along and say, okay, yes, you're doing well, except this one little thing. And then suddenly it's like a light bulb goes off and wow.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as an outsider, golf is one of those things where, I mean, there's right and then there's right for you, you know, with mm-hmm. biomechanics and all, you know, all of that shit taken into consideration. And the difference between right for you and almost right for you in terms of results is night and day. And the visual difference, the feel as you're doing it between almost right for you and right for you is incredibly narrow. Like there's that disparity, right? It feels right. Why doesn't it look right? Like why am I bad at this game? And you turn that small knob. You discover that small thing that you wouldn't even have noticed until it was pointed out to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes all the difference. You know, the adjustment versus the difference in results is just, that disparity is just huge. And I think golf is one of those things. As somebody who is terrible at golf, I have played golf for, let's say, at least hit a driving range. I haven't in the past few years, but I've at least tried to hit a driving range once or twice a year, maybe do one or two rounds a year for like 25 years, but that's the extent of it. I'm worse now than I was 25 years ago.
You would be.
I'm not only bad, but I'm bad and old and fat, where I was just bad before.
It's one of those funny things, like golf specifically. And I mean, I don't want to turn this into a golf podcast because we'll turn off all two of our listeners. But golf is a funny game because I picked up the game back when wooden clubs were still wooden.
Mm-hmm.
I did actually, one of the clubs in the very first set that I ever played with actually had a wooden shaft in it. And golf instruction has changed so much since those days that it's quite frankly ridiculous. Like the things that are known now about what you do versus what actually happens is insane. Like I looked at myself on video, right? And the first thing that struck me was, holy shit, I'm fat. right. And I said that, I'm like, holy, like, wow. Like I knew I was chubby. Like I'm overweight. There's no doubt. But I looked at myself on video and thought like, oh, cause my image of myself is still 18 year old me, right? Like 4% body fat and like, you know, shaped like a carrot. And now I'm shaped like a pear. But I mean, I looked at my swing and I'm like, oh, wow. Like that's totally different from how this feels. Right. And the other thing that he adjusted, because I was having problems hitting my driver, and he said, you know, like you have to set up like this. And I'm like, I am set up like this. And he showed me the video. He's like, no, you're not. So, I changed the thing and it felt like I was basically leaning over. Like I felt like I was going to fall over setting up the ball. And he showed me the video and I hit the ball amazingly. He showed me the video and he's like, see, like that's what it should look like. I'm like, I leaned over maybe 2 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like I was going to fall over. I mean, that's one of those things, right? Like, what it feels like is not what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is reasonably universal across a large number of skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think just golf as a sport amplifies the impact of that more than a lot of things. Like, I'm not a golf fan. I'm a hockey fan. I watch, you know, lots and lots and lots of hockey.
Hang on. Hold on. Are you a hockey fan or are you a Leafs fan?
I'm both, sadly.
Okay. Fair enough. You know, fair enough.
Like, I'm a hockey nerd, right? Like, yeah. I'm into several hockey pools with strictly hockey analytics guys. Like,
I'd expect you to be a little bit more of a golf fan, seeing as you cheer for the Leafs. Sorry, I had to get the. I'm a Leafs fan as well. For those of you who are wondering why I'm giving him so much stick, it's because our team sucks.
So back to hockey. When you look at it, though, like, you see how the game has evolved over the years, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you go back and you look at, you know, and I'm not even talking about going back to original six era, you know, back in 1922 before the Great War, whatever. I'm talking about the 80s when Gretzky was putting up 92 goal seasons. You look at the people on the ice and you're like, okay, I kind of recognize the sport. There's an equipment difference. There's a training difference. There's, you know, a coaching difference. Goalies hadn't learned to be goalies yet. Like, you watch old time hockey games and you don't, like, the one thing that jumps out at you is like, what the fuck is that guy doing?
Yeah.
You know, it's not quite like, you know, Patrick Waugh came around and invented butterfly goaltending and, you know, all of a sudden the sport was changed. But when you go back and look at the old highlights, it almost seems that way.
He definitely brought that sort of forward. Because there was a time when it was like, some do, some don't. It's times when it's appropriate and when it's not. And now it's pretty much, this is what you do.
Yeah. I don't think it's a sport where the minute difference make as big of an impact as golf. But unlike baseball, which, like, you know, you look at the game now versus the old timey game and, like, you see the difference, right? Most of the differences are in the uniforms and, like, okay, the gloves look different and people in the stands are wearing suits. What the fuck?
Yeah, well,
you know, but the basics of the sport, the fundamentals of the sport have changed. Yeah. And it's a sport that, like, stops and starts and has these sort of digestible, concise chunks where the sport happens and then it resets every pitch. So it doesn't have an opportunity to look visually as different as some other sports do.
Mm-hmm.
Man, like my first set of golf clubs that I played with for years, and I say played with loosely because, again, I've always been bad, was like a 1965 maybe era set of McGregors.
You still have them?
I do not, unfortunately. My driver, like the size of the head on my driver, mm-hmm. would look like a 5-wood now.
No, 5-woods are bigger than that. Yeah. Well, see, this is one of those things where I have some nerdy numbers because I did actually build golf clubs for a little while. I say build. I basically ordered the parts and then glued them together. But the sort of those would have been about 90 cc's. Drivers now are 460 cc's, and they would be bigger if they were allowed to be. That's actually the legal limit according to the rules of golf. And 5-woods are typically around 200. So yeah. A 5-wood now is about double the size of your
drive. No wonder everybody's hitting it so hard and straight. You know, they're playing with a hockey stick now.
Well, here's the bizarre thing is that, you know, like the major increase in distance in golf is mostly due to fitness and training changes.
Sure.
And the ball. The ball has changed a ton. But you look at you go back and because the Wonderful World of Golf by Shell is some of those are on YouTube. So you get to watch like Jack Nicklaus play Sam Snead when Jack Nicklaus was a teenager, right? And they're playing with those tiny little wooden clubs because it is like 1967. And like they mostly back off for accuracy. But when they really crank it, they were hitting it over 300 yards back then. The difference, the major difference today is that if you don't hit it quite perfectly sweet, it still goes almost as far.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas back then, if you don't hit it exactly perfectly on a tiny little sweet spot, which is smaller than the size of a dime, it goes nowhere and probably crooked. So golf is hard. It used to be harder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to suck. Just suck fast.
Yeah. There was a chance I could have could have been into golf more. My grandfather was a big golfer. He actually used to golf with Arnold Palmer all the time.
Really?
Yeah, like they were acquaintances. I wouldn't say good friends, but good enough acquaintances to golf casually with each other. Now, this would have been, you know, Arnold Palmer would not have been
famous yet.
Oh, no, this would have been like sort of a lot of his sort of later career, I guess. Like I'm talking the mid 80s.
Oh, okay. He was getting ready to retire.
Yeah, like Jack Nicklaus would have kind of broken into the sport at this point and have been the big name of amongst active players kind of thing. You know, people were talking about Palmer the way we would talk about somebody like Gretzky now in sports, right? He's like the previous generation's great one or the previous generation before that. And he and my grandfather would still get together, you know, once or twice a year and go golfing together.
Yeah, that would have been a heck of an opportunity.
Yeah. Didn't work out. Listen, I don't got a golf body. Even when I was fit, I didn't really have a golf body.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of things. This is one of the things that the bro talked about when I had my lesson earlier this week. All of this is probably getting cut before this gets released, and that's fine. One of the things that, because I mentioned to him, like, golf instruction has changed. Like, the golf swing that they teach now is much different than, I mean, you go back and you look at Johnny Miller, who basically bends himself into a paperclip as he's swinging through the golf ball. And now it's like, and then it went through a period sort of in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, where you were meant to, like, bend your back and not your hips. And now they've basically said, yeah, that's probably a formula to kill yourself at a young age. And one of the things he said was, like, now we know that there are several different ways that you can generate power in the golf swing, right? And one of them is going to feel right to you. So rather than teach, you know, this is the way that you swing a golf club, there are some things that are constant, right? Like your hands should generally do this, your shoulders should generally do this, your feet should generally be in this position. But it used to be they taught you, like, your hips do not move laterally. And now we know that some people, that's just naturally what they do. The weird thing is that a lot of the things that people do wrong in the golf swing are because they're giving their brain the wrong instruction, right? Like, if you tell yourself, hit the ball, your brain goes, okay, I'm going to hit this ball in the most efficient way possible, which is to swing the club like an axe over your head, right? Which is why people slice. Whereas if you say, all right, I'm going to sweep this ball toward that basket, you probably do something approximating a good golf swing. So it's really a big psychological thing about, like, what are you actually trying to do? And for a very long time, the instruction that people were given was antithetical to doing that. And now they actually do sort of figure that out. It's like, okay, this is what you're trying to accomplish. What is the goal, as opposed to, you know, let me show you the path step by step. We're a golf podcast now.
We are. Let's fix that. So last time we spoke, I asked you if you'd been playing any video games, and the answer was no. Have you been playing any video games?
I loaded up Baldur's Gate. I did some dialogue with a flying elephant, and then I had to go to bed because it was late. So here's a question I wanted to ask you, actually. Like, trying to squeeze nerdy hobbies into life is hard. What time do you normally go to bed?
Generally around midnight.
Ooh, late. I turn into a pumpkin around 11.
Yeah, midnight, 12:30, sometimes 1 o'clock. And I'm still 7:30 is, like, the latest I'm usually getting up.
Well, I wonder, we should put out a poll to all of our loyal listeners. What time do you go to bed? And what time do you get up? Because I go to bed generally between 10:30 and 11, if I can manage it. Sometimes a little later than that, depending on what's going on. And I'm up every morning at 6:30. On the weekends, I sleep in till about 7.
I'm generally up at a roughly normal time on the weekends, too. Although the last couple of weekends, I've managed to sleep in.
Sleeping in has changed as well for me. Like, a lot in my youth, it would be like sleeping in meant staying in bed till noon or 1 o'clock. Now, for me, sleeping in is like 8 a.m.
I've been playing some video games.
Tell me about it.
I think I will.
I used to be an adventurer like you.
Stay a while and listen.
Now, I mentioned last episode, the episode before that, I'd been playing the Jedi Survivor game, sequel to Jedi Fallen Order. And I think at that point I was in the early stages of the game and I was sort of complaining about the way it was making me feel with my queasiness around heights and the vertigo and stuff that I was getting. Well, I've finished the game. I think I'm a little disappointed in it.
Oh.
It's one of those games where I probably should have played or replayed rather the first game before jumping into it so that I had a realistic point of comparison. It's been long enough since I played the first game that I wonder if my recollection of how much I enjoyed that game was skewed, or if there's aspects about that game that I'm just outright misremembering. It was fine. That's the way I'd sort of sum it up. There's some things that really jumped out at me this time that I don't really remember being so in your face in the first game. Now, it is a game that is sort of in the style of one of those open world action games meets kind of like a Soulsborne style game with a whole bunch of like collectible aspects and like not mini game aspects. It's got some of that in it, but, you know, it doesn't have besides spending like talent points and stuff, it doesn't have a bunch of traditional RPG mechanics. You're not finding loot that is tangible gear, improves your abilities. You're finding like cosmetic shit, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that it's tried to do to add more depth to the combat, like the core combat loop, is in my mind create sort of the illusion of depth more than real depth. At its soul, this is probably more accurately described as a platformer puzzle game with familiar combat mechanics, and those combat mechanics are kind of like a Dark Souls without the difficulty, recognizing patterns in combat, avoiding things that can't be blocked, parrying things that need to be parried, countering things that need to be countered. Not overly deep, not overly challenging, and that's fine because they do a pretty good job of making the combat feel cinematic. And my complaint isn't really about the combat. It's sort of everything that happens around the combat in the platforming and puzzle solving. First of all, this game for me, and this is one of the places where I'm betting my memory of the first game is just wrong, because it's been some time. But while the first game had a lot of platforming elements, parkour elements, to me, I remember them being more a natural part of the environments in game. Right? Like there wasn't just, here's a floating platform that does stuff because it would be, you know, a challenge for a platformer game. Like you go back to playing games like Super Mario Brothers, where you would have platforms that are just floating in the sky like this so that you could jump on it, you know, and that you had to time it.
It's a platformer.
Right. Where the first game, it was like, there, yes, there was some of that, but, you know, it was blended into the design of the environment and world in a way that it, you know, didn't stick out like a sore thumb as being, oh, it's just a floating platform because this is a platformer. And so much more of this game, the sequel, felt like that's just there because they need to add some difficulty in this section. And as you progress through the game, I guess most of the progression you get is unlocking new abilities that help with traversal. So you can jump, then you can double jump, then you can jump and do like sort of like a force dash or force push in midair to just sort of dive a little bit further. And the combination that you do those things is a little bit different. As you unlock all of those, you can reach places that you couldn't quite reach before or whatever. So as you push further and further into the game, you know, at its simplest level, that's how the platforming works. It's take these new abilities and string them together so that you can reach that place that an hour ago you wouldn't have been able to reach. And that's fine when it is like jumping and flipping and force stuff. The things that really stuck out in this game for me is the, first of all, you have a little droid that you have with you, BD-1, who is, I think, objectively the best Star Wars droid. They try to make droids cute in Star Wars, And, yeah. You know, after, with the exception of 3PO, has always been a creep. They've tried to make droids cute, and in the prequel movies, the BB-8. Yeah, he was kind of cute. But this little guy literally just rides on your back. He's like a little parrot slash dog kind of thing that he's always chirping at you. And like, it's just the animation team and design team deserves awards for just how unbearably adorable they've made this little droid. Like when you're sitting like meditating at a little point, you know, he sort of sits down like a little person with his feet sticking out, or he'll be waiting for you to do something in the ship and he's just kind of like watching around, or he's just sort of got his head turned towards you, just following you with like adoration in his little robot projector eyes. He's amazing. Like from the first game, the second game, he's absolutely amazing. Visually, you know, just, can't help but like fall in love with the little guy. But they kept giving him abilities that you have to use, not for your traversal stuff, but for your puzzle solving stuff, which functionally speaking, what they amount to is almost like the older combat games where you had stances that you had to dance between. For him, it wasn't stances. It was change into this mode and you can shock something. Change into this mode and you can... something in it called Kobo matter, which is sort of this thing that you can imagine, you know, like you're spray bombing something, you know, and when you connect it to certain other things, some shit can happen or whatever. Like there's just a lot of that where it's like, oh, so I'm doing something different, but it's only visually different because instead of shocking something, I'm painting something now, or vice versa.
That kind of fits thematically in the idea of a Star Wars droid, though. Because if you think about it, like, there's a lot of, like, if you think back to original Star Wars, right, one of the things that happens is that R2-D2 sticks his robot penis into the you know, carburetor controller.
Mm-hmm. And that was always there. There's a certain amount of, like, ooh, go fuck that machine and open that door.
Right.
That's there from the very beginning. It's the stuff where all the momentum stops and you got to survey your environment and decide, okay, which one of these seven things that all functionally do something similar but look different is the right one that I need to use here. Okay, well, I can see a thing over there. I can shock. I see one of those orb things over here and a bunch of matter over there, so let me switch to paint mode. Like, it almost at points starts to feel more like the old school point and click puzzle games where you're just, you're waiting to hover over the right spot on the screen until you find something that you can click on. Or you're looking at the screen and you're waiting to, you've got an inventory full of items and you need to drag the right one out onto the right thing in what should be like a high paced, thrilling action platformer game, to me, just it erodes all of that momentum and all of that.
I'm sorry, you're making a really good point, but you talk about an inventory full of things and I flash back. Do you remember Yahtzee? He does a like a sort of a like 90-second review.
Of zero games. Punctuation. Well, it's fully ramblematic now that he's over on the second win. Yep.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about one of his early ones was about one of those games. It was Monkey Island or Day of the Tentacle or whatever it was. It was a like a revamp of it. And he's like, so basically you just carry around this bag of stuff and you sequentially take everything out of the bag and rub it on everything in the room until you find the thing that rubbing this thing on this other thing solves the puzzle, and then you carry on.
And that's kind of what this game feels like. Like the action platformer stops and I'm not literally taking stuff out of a bag, but you know, functionally speaking, the difference is pretty minimal. I'm going to my droid's vision mode and I'm looking at what he can see and I'm making sure that he's in the right mode so that I can click the thing.
This would be an ideal kind of little brother co-op game opportunity. Where, I don't know if there was anyone ever did this. I think there was something with one of the Kirby games or something. But imagine that you're playing like Super Mario Brothers and your little brother wants to play, little sister, whatever. right? And they're not really old enough to understand what's going on, but they want to help and they want to have fun. And I remember seeing it was probably a Reddit post somewhere, where someone said it would be great if you had sort of a little brother mode where they can't die, they're not really contributing much, but, you know, they get to follow along and they get to participate. This would be a great opportunity for something like that, where you've got somebody who sort of wants to experience the story with you, but doesn't really want to get involved in, okay, so how do I control stuff? Yeah. And they control the droid, and it's like, okay, see that red button? You need to push that while I do go do the complicated thing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been some games that have tried it. I think, was it Secret of Mana or Secret of Evermore? One of them, second player, essentially could play as, like, the dog.
Yeah, that might be what I'm thinking of. I never played it. I had heard about it.
Yeah. So, and there's games where those mechanics fit. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't feel like that game. And it just feels to me like it's just...
It feels an awful lot, the way you're describing it, it feels an awful lot like the cutscenes that they put into a lot of games where you can't just watch the cutscene. You have to, like, press F to pay.
Yeah, like, it's sort of quick time eventy. It's like having a combination lock and asking you to pick it. But there's only one number in the combination. Like, you're going to get it. There's no challenge to it. You got to start at one. Does that do it? No. Start at two. Does that do it? No. So it just, it's like illusion of depth. You know, it isn't adding challenge. It's only adding visual complexity. It isn't forcing you to think about puzzles significantly differently. It is just blue instead of red, you know?
Yeah. Here's a funny thing though. And I have, you're a pretty smart guy. Giving you puzzles that would be challenging would probably leave a lot of people struggling and frustrated with the game. And there's a balance to be found, no doubt.
Yeah.
The reason I say this, I don't know if I told you this, but we did an escape room at work, right? And because we were one of the design teams, we were sort of tasked with making the puzzles for the room. And I came up with this puzzle, and it's literally all it is it's a gearbox with like five gears in it and a crank handle, right? Mm-hmm. And I 3D printed it out, and there are little sort of mastermind sort of four color dots in various places, right? So there's like a green dot, a red dot, a yellow dot, a blue dot, yada, yada, yada. And as you crank them, because the gears are different sizes, the dots are in different orientations. And there's four arrows on the top, and there's a clue that says red, green, blue, yellow, make the colors all the same. So here's my question to you. Like, you can crank the handle. That's literally all you can do. So what are you going to do? Irrespective of you being colorblind, you have friends who can tell you what colors they are.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would do is just put the handle in and crank it and see what happens. How do the things move?
Right. So one of them turns faster than the others. So eventually, like, dots.
They're probably going to line up.
Right. And you would go, okay, well, all of the colors need to be the same under the arrows, right?
Yep.
People absolutely flatlined on that puzzle.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about, like, okay, I cranked it and it doesn't seem. And here's the thing is that it was actually set up so you had to crank the handle three times to line up the colored dots. And a whole bunch of very smart people absolutely flatlined. They're just like, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things where, like, the tease to the solution, you overthink it. You think that the solution is more complex. Like, this game, it's a little bit different. Do you remember those toys that, like, children would have, young toddlers, where it's like a round ball that has cutout shapes in it, and then you'd have the little blocks that were those shapes, and you would put them in?
Those are for kids. I still have one.
It's like that. It's not like, ooh, I wonder which tool I'm using here. It's like, oh, I see the round thing over there. Let me get out the round thing and put it in there. Oh, I see the star thing over here. Let me get the star one out and put it there. So, yes, okay, maybe I look at puzzles a little bit differently than the average person. I find it tedious. I would question whether the average person who maybe doesn't find it tedious would ever find it fun. Because there's a distinction there.
That is a very good and a very fair point. I agree. A lot of times, like, I find even Baldur's Gate is fantastically designed. And I do have to say that I have one thing to say, because I did a little bit more. I think I played for about a half hour. I talked to Raphael, and I lied to the Emperor about what I talked to him about and succeeded, which I found really amusing. I'm like, oh, this is probably going to kill me and end my honor mode run. And it's like, oh, okay, well, I guess I believe you or whatever. But there's things like, even when playing something as good as Baldur's Gate, I find sometimes the puzzles are tedious because the solution, and part of it is me, right? Because I mean, I solve problems for a living. So I spend 10 hours a day figuring out how to solve complicated problems. So a lot of times it's like, okay, the problem, like I know the solution to the problem, but it means I have to run across town 5 times. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, on the one hand, I do love, you know, the visuals in the game, but after you've run across town 4 times to go, like I have to fetch a rabbit and then I have to fetch, you know, something else. And then I have to fetch a cabbage or whatever. And okay, so now I've cooked the Haas and Pfeffer and I get the magical ring of awesomeness. There's a certain amount of any kind of puzzle solving that's tedious. Like, I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I'm just, it's, I think that where that tedium sets in is different based on who you are.
Sure.
You talked about parkour. Have you ever played Just Cause?
Very, very briefly.
Just Cause 4 is worth a look, I think, because they sort of had refined things. So there's 3 things. You have a parachute, which is infinitely usable, which is, I mean, it's bullshit, but it's a lot of fun. You have a wingsuit, once again, which is infinitely usable, and you have a grappling hook, right? So you can grappling hook up, use the parachute to sort of pull the cord, shoot yourself up a little bit more, and then like wingsuit off a cliff. And I never got anywhere in the game because all I did was find the highest mountain I could and just like wingsuit and parachute all over the place. Because it was a ton of fun.
Mm-hmm. And the traversal mechanics in this game probably feel similar to that because you got a lot of the same tools. Like you can't fly, but you have grappling hook, jump, double jump, sort of a force dash in midair kind of thing. If you force dash through a force field, it'll reset your jump. So you start stringing together combinations of that stuff. You got wall running shit that's happening. And that all feels pretty good. The world design is just so obviously designed around those mechanics, right? So it just doesn't feel natural in the way I remember the first game feeling it. The one thing I will say, sort of circling back to something that you said, is the world in this game, I have a lot of issues with it, but it is designed in such a way that it is meant to alleviate a lot of that traveling back and forth, where it's like, ooh, I got to find the long way around, but once I do, I unlock the shortcut to bring me instantly back to where I want to go. The first game had a lot of backtracking in it, and this game has almost none because conveniently, the world design is built around looping you back to where you started, basically.
Do you remember, speaking of world design, do you remember Need for Speed Underground 2? Mm-hmm. I loved that game so much. And I know like you actually did some racing, so I'm sure that the physics in it, especially once you upgrade your cars somewhat, become ludicrous and unreal. But I found the world design in that game to be nearly perfect. And I think I remember reading somewhere that they actually designed a city, like the roads in a city and the overpasses and the highways and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they went, okay, this is what this race course is going to look like. And it used streets. And it really did feel very organic. Like you were racing down, you know, highways and down street level streets and stuff. And when they do the design like that, it feels a lot more sort of organic and real. And not enough game designers do that. They do exactly that. They go, you know, like, what puzzles have we got? Okay, what do we have to design in between the puzzles?
Yeah.
And that kind of circles back to actually designing D&D adventures. Because there's a danger that you run into there where you go, okay, I've designed this big world, but what happens in it? Right? Whereas most of the time, especially in D&D, really what you need is, here's a bunch of stuff that's going to happen, and all of the traveling in between is just a montage with maybe a random encounter in the middle of it. Right? You don't need a giant world. You need a bunch of sort of rooms and dungeons and maybe a small town.
Well, why don't we talk about that a little bit more then?
We've rescheduled our Sunday game 3 times now.
It's been my fault. Well, our fault twice, really.
Kind of.
We had the one weekend we couldn't do it, and then last weekend, this weekend just passed. I thought we could do it, but apparently the plans that I thought were on Saturday were actually on Sunday, and we couldn't. So,
well, that's fine, because we actually couldn't either. Cindy had something going on, and I was busy Sunday morning.
So I have to give you credit for something.
Huzzah!
I stole a shared idea. You said something offhand during our last session when we were talking about what I had going on in my Tuesday game. And I ended up poaching the idea. Like, it was in line with what I was already doing. So, you know, the idea wasn't in a vacuum. But you remember I was talking about how I was creating consequences for my players' inaction. And I'd set up that whole sort of TV broadcasty running man kind of thing with them. And I'd mentioned that I had them go through what was essentially like the gauntlet for season one of the show. And you said, oh, so the footage is them going through the dungeon that they'd already gone through. No, because my intention was to have them go through something new. And like, they were either going to choose to go through it or they were going to lose and be forced to go through it. I was railroading them a little bit, but they were cool with it. But what I did end up role-playing out was that they were being observed going through that first dungeon, and it was basically set up as like a hype reel for them. So they eventually found their way into trying to rescue their friends, I guess. I don't want to call them companions. They're people they hadn't met that long ago, but they came into the Shadowfell together with them, sort of separated when they got to this city. And as part of my setup for this gauntlet thing, Blood and Glory, the tieflings that they failed to rescue were sort of the first combatants thrown into it. They watched them get mowed down, and then they teased. The next day's events introduced sort of the combatants, and it was going to be their other friends that they actually gave a shit about. So they decided, all right, we're going to go in there and figure out our way in and rescue it. Perfect. They ended up finding their way into the gauntlet, found a portal room, picked a portal at random, which led them to a specific spot. They realized they got in, they couldn't get out, and they had to wait for a couple of minutes while this little, like, observer construct was floating around, just projecting a countdown at them. Broadcast starts in X number of hours. And we ended the session on me basically doing a hype reel based on all of this stuff. And my satisfaction out of this is I'm actually using it almost as a way to express my frustration at just how in your face all the shit about sports gambling is right now.
Oh my God.
Right? Like, it doesn't matter what you watch. It's just, you know, for context, sports betting recently became legal in Canada, particularly in Ontario where we live. And you can't watch, read, smell, shit, piss without some sort of in-your-face advertising regarding sports betting. Every podcast that you listen to is sponsored by one of 3 or 4 different sports books. Every commercial break's got 2 different competing sports books advertising. It's fucking painful. I know it's a bubble that's going to burst because there isn't enough demand for that many. So they're all spending bajillion dollars on marketing, trying to be one of the like 2 or 3 that's going to be left standing at the end
survivors.
Of
survivors.
Yeah. And I get that, but like this period right now is just unbearable.
This podcast sponsored by Back to the Future Sports Betting.
Yeah. So I'm playing it up in my game where like this one of the bad guys that are in this city that they've been dealing with. I mean, he dabbles in most of the criminal underbelly, but the one thing that he's doing right now is running this sort of blood sport broadcast where he's going into every tavern and every sort of establishment in the city with these magical projectors, playing these events. And there's bookies on site taking people's bets, and they're setting odds and you know, obviously raking in a ton of cash doing it. The only people that ever win is the house. And my players are going to try and either prove that right, depending on which, you know, how they perform, or prove it right, depending on how they fail, because they're being hyped up. Like, they're intentionally hyping up my players as if they're going to be some sort of like uber champions, right? They've mm-hmm. bypassed the competition. They've broken the tournament ladder. They've proven themselves worthy of the ultimate blood and glory challenge. Play the hype reel, play the countdown, introduce the team. That's where we end the session. But that idea of taking the footage of them in the previous dungeon and using it, showing it to them without actually showing it to them, that you mentioned, I stole. So credit to you for that. I yoinked it. Don't be afraid to yoink a good idea, Dungeon Masters.
Steal from the best. Listen, I mean, you read the original Dungeon Master's Guide written by Gary Gygax or Ed What's-His-Face or whoever the other guy was.
Don't read the AD&D one, man.
Yeah, no, don't. Do read chapter one. Seriously, read chapter one of the original AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide, because it doesn't actually have any rules in there. It just has some advice about stuff. And one of the things that they give you, the advice they give you, and it's good advice, pick something you love, steal it, use it wholesale. Change some names and some colors. Obviously, don't publish it because you're not allowed to do that. But for personal use around your table, absolutely steal it. And if you hear an idea that we come up with that you like, steal that too.
There was an interesting sort of episode. This isn't quite a parting gift, but I do listen to a podcast called Dungeon Master of None. And I find their new stuff a little bit painful. They don't really jive with me and how they sort of enjoy the game. That's fine. The game's meant to be enjoyed in a million different ways. But they really recently did a podcast revolving around this article, which was all about how people sort of enjoyed the game and the problems that Dungeon Masters had back in the old days.
Ooh, the Grognard problem.
Well, it was very much like a situation that DMs would create for themselves by giving their players everything they want, like in a way that you don't with modern games. Like, it was almost structured like a Dear Editor kind of situation where you wrote in asking a question. We're hoping for some sort of constructive feedback, right? And almost all of the questions were, my player is a level 9,000 this and this and has 17 star destroyers and 14 blah, blah, blahs and you know, just made up shit. They're like, oh, you have star destroyers in your Dungeons & Dragons game. How do you build an adventure around all of that?
It's challenging at times. There's an interesting thing. I used to be a part of, I think I've mentioned this before, I used to be part of a forum, and I don't know if it exists anymore, that Gary Gygax and, I always forget the guy's name, he runs a bakery now, or he's probably dead now. He was old then. Who wrote the BECMI series of manuals, which was before or sort of parallel with Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. It was like beginner, expert, something, master, immortals. Mm-hmm. And no one ever used really the immortals rules because it became difficult. Like it is a creativity challenge for the DM to give you a challenge on the level of like, hey, you're basically gods now. Like what kind of challenges can we offer? But they change, right? And that's the thing, is that we're sort of programmed. You see it in the way that that MMORPGs are created. You start off at level one, you know, punching snakes and nearly dying, and you get to level 500 and you're still punching snakes. It's just the snakes are bigger and they have more mechanics now. Mm-hmm. Right? But the basic premise doesn't change. And I mean, D&D can be fun like that. Games can be fun like that. But once you start giving people power, it becomes more of a challenge to give them something meaningful to do.
Yeah. It was an interesting look back just at how people thought about it differently, though, because the general consensus coming out of it was, it's okay to end your campaign and start fresh. And nobody did that back then. You know, I've been playing this game for 7 years and, you know, my people are all gods. And what do I do? The idea of wrapping up your campaign in sort of a satisfying way and then starting a new campaign, it's almost like it didn't occur to a lot of people back then.
Oh, I'm sure it didn't. I know that we more often than not, the group that I played with, more often than not, they just sort of petered out in the summer camp. Like, because we play for the winter and usually into like April, May, and then it would just, the idea would die. And in September or October, we'd go, hey, do we want to play D&D again? Yeah. Should we pick up where we left off? I don't know where my character sheet is. I don't remember anything that happened. Okay, let's just start again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, hey, it's a luxury. You've had a group that you could keep together to put in the number of sessions you need to have this problem. You're the lucky one, fucker.
Yep.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, like the mentality seemed very much different. Like that it was just unthought of to put a nice little bow on your campaign, have a sort of a satisfying climax, and, you know.
Yeah.
Like that people were so, and this sort of ties into something that I want to talk about today. Players' attachment to player characters and how it's different in sort of different game formats and styles.
It's different. There's a lot of things about the way that people talk about Dungeons and Dragons now that's very, very different from when I started playing.
Mm-hmm.
Like the idea of was it Bales and something? Which is, I mean, it's a really great idea. It's like, here's some shit that I just literally do not want to talk about. Like, fair enough. Like, that's something that we should get, because it's a social game, right? We need new rules of society. But there was, like, that was a new concept to me when you brought it up the first time. There's a bunch of stuff just reading on, like, the D&D Next subreddit, where it's like people are talking about how they interact with each other. I mean, some of the stuff on the D&D Next subreddit is quite, frankly, seriously, people just talk to each other.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff that comes up where it's like, I'm not sure how to address this. And I'm like, I didn't even realize that was a question. People think differently. And that's cool. We're communicating more. I think our communication net goes a lot wider since the advent of the internet.
So getting onto the main thing that I wanted to talk about here in Table Talk, I have been slowly over the past months laying the groundwork for so many campaigns. I've mentioned before, didn't go over well either time, I think, that I talked about it, the idea of doing some paid DM work, because people have been asking me to do some of it. And I'm like, well, I talk to so many people that just assume I'm getting paid to do it now anyway. If there's an opportunity there, maybe I'll explore it and see how it works. But the idea was that I wanted to do some mini campaigns. Mm-hmm. To me, it was more about not having a super long-term commitment, right? Like, you do something 6, 7, 8 sessions, wrap it up, and if I wanted to run that same basic content again, I could do it again. That appealed to me, you know, just from the mechanics of preparation and stuff like that. Like, I could build this almost like a module, my own homebrew adventure module, and kind of run it. And that's sort of the way I was thinking about it at the time.
It's a lot like how teachers prep, right? Like, the first year that you teach grade one, it's tough.
Yeah.
You gotta pair everything. Second time, bunch easier.
Yeah. One thing that I've been doing very, very recently, and I kicked you a link last week to some stuff, I've been catching up on some older Dimension 20 actual play stuff. So this is the group that was College Humor, is now Dropout TV. They run their own streaming thing. I actually just subscribed to it the other day because it's cheap and it's got a lot of shit on it that I've wanted to watch. And I'm like, fuck it. I'll do it for a couple months and see if it sticks. But I wanted to watch some of the Dimension 20 stuff. Specifically, I've recently watched The Ravening War, and I'm getting into Crown of Candy right now. Most of the Dimension 20 stuff, if you haven't run across it, is very, very different from Critical Role, in that it is short, contained sort of, they do mini campaigns, their side quest stuff, which is usually like 6 episodes. Mm-hmm. And then they have their longer sort of, they're still mini campaigns, but they're like 16 episodes. And because they're only like 2-hour-ish episodes in terms of the length of time, and some of that's edited down, realistically, almost 2 of them equals what would be 1 game session if you're running like a 4-hour session once a week kind of thing. So it's a good analogy for like what could be, or a good way to look at what could be different in mini campaigns versus one shots or long campaigns. And one thing that I've really picked up on watching the Dimension 20 stuff, I love Brendan Lee Mulligan. I don't know if you ever watched it, but I kicked you the Escape from the Bloodkeep stuff, which was the like Lord of the Rings parody shit that they did years and years ago.
I haven't watched it, no. I have a backlog of stuff that Shane has sent me that I need to watch that is quite impressive.
What I will say is that it isn't for everybody. It is very much new D&D. So if you are
a Grognard
of the old school, you may find these people sort of crossing that line into being, I don't want to say annoying, but these are people that are all talented improv people. Like, that's what they're doing. Like, they, you know, they do improv shit as their main thing. The D&D stuff is kind of the side game. It's like Critical Role, and they have their voice actors and stuff, right? Like, this is their sort of spin on that. And a lot of these people are voice actors too, but it is like the enthusiasm is up to 11, you know, like all the time. It is performative in addition to being, you know, D&D. And that maybe isn't for everyone. Once you get past it, though, I mean, there's some really amazing sort of shit. Like, it, I sort of float on that line of like any one of these people by themselves, I enjoy a lot. Put them all together, and sometimes it's just a little bit much, but it's worth getting over that. I mentioned the Ravening War and Crown of Candy specifically. First of all, these are very, very goofy, ridiculous examples of just fun world building, in that these are basically Game of Thrones. Like, they're cutthroat, bloody, absolute gritty fantasy, except the worlds are literally these worlds where everybody's some sort of food, right? Like, you know, you got a kingdom where everybody's made out of candy. You got Vegetania and Fructera, and you've got the Meatlands. And so all of the characters are these things that are made out of some sort of food. And like, it's all themed that way, in contrast to the fact that it is basically like Game of Thrones. Like, it is got that much intrigue and just sort of want and violence and all of that shit. Contrast with you're playing, you know, gingerbread men and gummy bears, and it is quite fun. Just in that setup alone, it's worth checking out.
I mean, it's brilliant, but it's also very ridiculous.
It is.
I find speaking of like the turned up to 11, I enjoy that in short bursts. There's a complaint that I have about some movies. You'll see this like when they're talking about some things on Red Letter Media. Is it like in any sort of especially long format stuff, you have to have, you know, it builds up to something, and then you have some sort of event, and then you need a minute afterwards of calm to digest all of the enthusiasm that's come before. So when it's turned up to 11 all the time, I find it becomes tedious.
I might be sort of misrepresenting what this is. The enthusiasm isn't, like, the energy isn't always at 11, right?
Okay.
The enthusiasm and buy-in is, but also the very setup for the game. And this is why I want to talk about mini campaigns specifically, because there's a few interesting things that I've noticed now that I'm paying attention to this style of game more. And it's not something that I've ever really played in. It's not something that I've ever really run. My campaign's been going on for a couple of years. I've played in campaigns that go on for a couple of years. I've done a whole bunch of one-shot stuff, but this sort of sweet spot in the middle is more interesting than I thought it was.
It can be.
I was sort of looking at it as like, hey, it's a way of getting some games in without a super long-term commitment. I have a chance to tell a story. I can reuse content. But I never really thought about it from like how players engage with it differently. And caveat, I am talking about performative players that are playing in a product, right? Dimension 20 is a product. They're putting on a show. That's not how everybody plays D&D. But
no, but it is rewarding when you get some players who buy into that level.
And what I found about the mini campaigns is that the players seem to buy in differently in a couple of different ways. So one, there's a balance between sort of that on rails style of gameplay that you would more traditionally get with a one shot, where it's like, this is the thing we're doing. Now, when you're doing an actual play show that involves like actual sets and boards that they set up for playing on minis, like that format necessitates a little bit of on the rails stuff. Now, I'm amazed at how they managed to strike the balance between player agency and freedom and still direct it back to these set piece sort of encounters, right? Like, they really walk that line well, where, and it's what we do in our longer campaigns. We do this to a lesser degree too, But, you know, for these mini campaigns, maybe they'll have throughout the mini campaign, six sort of set pieces, which like this is where we're going to bust out the minis and have this nice presentation and combat's going to happen. And the windy road we follow to get here, the circumstances that actually take place here might vary depending on player choice and stuff. But you have these prepared set pieces that are kind of ready to go.
Milestones.
Yes. The way they've been able to, where in a one shot, it's like, you know, very much theme park roller coaster strap in. This is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. At least as a passive observer watching these mini campaigns feels much less like that. Even though mechanically speaking, it still has to be, right? You're not running around waiting to react and split the road off in drastically different directions, depending on what the players are doing. You're guiding them into these sort of milestones that you want them to hit, but you're not, you know, you're steering them. You're not strapping them in and taking them along for the ride. Like, you're making them want to go where you want to go. And there's two things that have sort of contributed to that. Because it is a finite campaign, you are able to make every session feel epic in a way that with a long campaign, you just can't.
Well, you shouldn't either.
No, you absolutely shouldn't.
Because you end up with the MCU problem of the space laser has to get bigger every time that you do a movie.
And they've done with D20. I watched them in reverse order. The first series they aired was Crown of Candy, which was just a regular D20, regular sort of season 16-18 thing. I've just started watching that now. The Ravening War was technically a prequel to that, and Matt Mercer actually ran this game. And it's interesting to see just how different it is compared to the stuff we normally know Matt Mercer for, with the exception of the fact that you've got all talented, charismatic, trained improv and voice actors and stuff around the table, right? This could not feel more different from Critical Role while having a lot of familiar faces. A lot of the people that are involved in this have guested on various Critical Role stuff. Brendan Lee Mulligan did Xandria Unplugged or something like that. Anyway, it was amazing how different it felt. Like Critical Role, I've tried to get into it a few times, and it's just, it's a slog.
It's too big.
It is too big. And I say that trying to, you know, consume this as an entertainment product. If somebody were to try and follow along with a campaign that I'm running, they would say the same thing about what I'm doing. Like my game, look, I'm not comparing myself to Matt Mercer. I'm not comparing my shit to the quality of stuff that they do for Critical Role, but like,
you know what? Your hair is not nearly as good as his. I'm sorry.
Right. But mechanically speaking, like when you look at the amount of stuff that happens over a set length of time, going on for multiple years, like there's a comparison that can be drawn there, right?
Yes, like for sure.
Like if I were to sit down and try and explain everything that's happened in the particular campaign that I'm running for my Tuesday group, we'll be a week.
You'd spend a year doing a podcast once a week and talking about it for a solid 20 minutes.
And that just scratches the surface, right? Like,
oh yeah,
that's barely the Coles Notes version of it. Like that is,
yeah, that's the executive summary.
Yeah. So the Dimension 20 stuff is very, very much like the opposite of that. It is short, canned, finite, and the difference both in the delivery and planning and setup, but of the flow of the episodes, right? They feel more formulaic. And normally when you say formulaic, it's a bad thing, but it doesn't come across as a bad thing here. Where there's a certain rhythm where every episode gets its sort of climax, and it doesn't necessarily mean big encounter, right? Mm-hmm. It just means that there's a ramping up and down of the stakes, a ramping up and down of different types of tension, a ramping up and down of emotion, one way or another, whether it's action, whether it's drama, whether it's humor sometimes. Every sort of session or episode kind of has this natural climax of some sort, and there's a certain amount of preparation and stuff that can happen to support that. You couldn't do that in a, you know, 37,000 episode campaign or session campaign where you can do that with, like, I know this is going to be 10 sessions or 8 sessions.
Yeah, you can definitely, you can sort of graph it out a little better or chart it in some way that you can make it fit. It would be a whole lot easier as a consumer of that content too, to go, okay, well, it's still a lot. It's like 32 hours or something, right? Of a campaign. But even still, it's like, okay, well, that's 32. I'm going to listen to it on my way into and home from work. And you can consume that in, say, a month.
But the most interesting difference that I've picked up on that I never really thought about before is the difference in how players buy into their characters and approach things like risk. You take a long campaign like mine, player character deaths are always something that can happen. But for the most part, you're not planning on them happening next week or the week afterwards. They're always the, if it happens, it happens, but ideally I don't want it to happen kind of thing. Because you want to be playing this character that you've put time into and grown to love a year from now, if at all possible.
Well, especially after you've spent a year developing their story. Mm-hmm. It's like, I've spent a year on this character. I want to see some kind of conclusion to their story.
Yeah, and on the other extreme, in the case of a one-shot, often it's just a very disposable character that you'd have no depth. You as a player don't have any real attachment to it. So the gameplay, like, it lacks the stakes, even though you might approach using that character a little bit differently.
Sorry, I just remembered. I did actually make a couple of notes of things that I wanted to say during this episode. So you bring up one-shots, and I played in one of your one-shots for the Lucky Sevens. And I would just like to read you 2-point form notes that I made during the sort of introduction-ish, or partway through the introduction to that adventure. So note number one, might be a bum hole. Note number two, follow up to the first. Definitely a bum hole.
Yeah, one shots hit different and they're fun for what they are.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, you know, players being attached to the characters and getting the payoff of emotional investment, it isn't there for one shots. Yeah. What I've found watching a few different mini campaigns now, and again, I haven't run one like this myself, is that the players seem to find that balance between I'm invested in this character and like emotionally attached to its successes and failures, but at the same time I know I'm not going to be playing this character in 6 weeks or whatever, so I'm willing to risk this character's life more than I would be in a regular campaign. I'm willing to have them act in heroic ways or epic ways or take risks or perform sacrifices, emotional sacrifices that I would never really consider in a long campaign, because I'm playing what feels right for the game, not what feels right necessarily for myself as a person that's attached to this character, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's something to be said for a movie like Rogue One to bring Star Wars into this. And I know not everybody liked Rogue One.
I thought it was okay.
I actually liked it. Like, I put it up there with some of the best Star Wars, in my opinion. But one of the interesting differences, and this is what rubs people the wrong way, is you know everybody dies. Or there's a good chance everybody dies.
Most of them are going to die. Many Bothans died to bring us this information.
But if you look at it from the perspective of the characters that die, their heroic actions, imagine playing as them, right?
You know you're going to die in the end, so it's fine.
Yeah. You're willing to do things that you might not do. You're willing to do, you, maybe even it's even like crossing moral boundaries that you might not normally consider crossing. You're willing to die. And in the Dimension 20 games, they roll back up characters before they even start episode one, because there's a good chance that characters might die, but I've found that in the ones that I've watched, where it has happened, it's usually happened in the finale, conveniently enough. And the sacrifice of the character or the death, you know, the cost, narratively speaking, of that climax hits completely differently. Now, don't get me wrong, If after session 176 of an ongoing regular campaign, a character dies, that's going to hit hard. But that just doesn't, you can't count on that happening unless like a player comes to you and says, you know what, I want to retire this character. Let's give him a good send off. And you can kind of plan around that.
My favorite character retirement, though, is a player that comes to you and says, you know, I kind of want to play a different character. Can this character just retire? And it's like, yeah. You know, you get off the ship at the port of wherever, and this one character goes, you know what, I don't think I want to do this anymore. I think I've lost enough fingers.
I'm too old for this shit.
Hey, I'm 7 days from retirement. You mentioned Star Wars, and you know what? This is one of those things where, like on Red Letter Media, they do this, you know, where they're reviewing a movie, and either Mike or Rich will bring up Star Trek like 17 seconds into whatever it is. I really want to start doing like a checklist or something. I'm not going to do it because it's actually work and I'd have to think about it. But you mentioned Star Wars, and I was reading a post that from somebody, and it was really sort of interesting what they were posting, and I don't remember what it was, but something stuck out to me. And I think that you will resonate with this. So their sort of opening was, I was either too young or not yet born when the first 6 Star Wars movies came out. And I'm like, the first 6?
God.
There's no first 6. There's the first 3, and then there's the prequels. Like, it's not the first 6 movies. I understand the perspective of where they're coming from, and I don't have an issue with it, but it definitely punched me in the gut as I went, oh my God, I remember when there was only one. Like, I vaguely remember. Like, I was 4 or 5, I think, when Empire came out. And I saw it at a drive-in. Remember those?
Mm-hmm.
We still have one, I think. I think. I don't know. I haven't been to an actual movie in a long, long time. But just the idea that someone thinks of, like, episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 as the first 6 movies just makes me go, where did my life go?
Man, I remember when they didn't call them episodes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Star Wars, the crawl does open with the episode number, but...
Not originally.
I'm pretty sure it did. We're going to have a nerd fight about whether or not that's true. I'm pretty sure it was called Episode 4 Star Wars. Anyway, it's not really important, but there it is.
One more quick thing that I want to talk about, which I found interesting in watching the Ravening War series that I did. The basic setup for it is there was a sort of historical event that gets referred to in Crown of Candy, kind of like talking about the Clone Wars in Star Wars, mm-hmm. where they decided over this 6-episode sort of mini campaign to set these characters up and sort of play them at different stages throughout this 5, 6, 8, however many year event that happened. So for a lot of the episodes, they did time jumps. Yes, you level up, and yes, it's a few years later. But what I found interesting in how they handled this, and this is sort of what I was referencing when I kicked you the link to see the videos, is that rather than sort of playing the characters the way you would normally play them, they sort of zoomed way out to this, like, you know, you're looking at the map, basically, of the region. Imagine, you know, Middle Earth, or...
It's like a campaign map as opposed to a... It's like going back to the origins, I put the accent on the wrong syllable, of D&D and chainmail to, instead of controlling a single character, you're controlling an army.
Yeah, and this wasn't quite that, but there was a lot of opportunities that were role played out where it was like, okay, 2 years are going to pass. In 2 years, what would your character be doing? Well, I think I want to spend some time, you know, trying to infiltrate, you know, the church here in this country or something like that. It's like, okay, well, what kind of things would you like to try and achieve during this 2 years towards that goal? And rather than like rolling things like history checks and insight checks and deception checks for individual actions, they would use the same rolls. So you're using your character's stats, but they're being applied more broadly to like chunks of action and story. And then depending on the role, the narration is going to sort of fill in the gaps of here's the things that you've tried to do. Here's how you've succeeded and the ramifications and consequences. Here's the ways in that you weren't able to succeed and the ramifications and consequences. And that stuff sort of builds into the story of this is what the world state is going to be at the end of our time jump. And here's the tools that you're going to have available to you based on that shit that we played out. But it was legit role played out. Everybody had an opportunity to be super creative and start thinking bigger picture, right? Thinking about the region, the world, and how they can leave an impact on it above and beyond. I hit the rat. I hit the bigger rat. I hit the bigger rat.
And that is how, I mean, that's the progression, I think, that they envisioned with the original sort of progression from basic to expert to, you know, master and whatever, is that you go from, and it's sort of reflected in 5e and the sort of, you know, the way they describe the levels, where it's like you start off as, you know, a peasant farmer, and then you become a local hero, and then you become sort of like a worldwide hero, and then you become, basically, you are a massive international influence. Mm-hmm. But it's tough, and that's a really good way to do it. It's tough to sort of show that progression and involve the players in it. That's a really creative way to do that.
It is a creative way, and it was executed well. And again, this is not something that you would have seen in a Critical Role thing, so that it was coming from Matt Mercer doing it was unique for him, I think. I haven't seen him do anything like this before. But it was also, we've talked about, and we sort of hinted at it earlier in our discussion, what do you do with high-level characters when they're too powerful and they need to function less like individuals and more like part of bigger systems and stuff like that? One of the other things that we've talked about before is like how you need to think about certain mechanics and things in Dungeons & Dragons is like luck rolls. Mm-hmm. And while, yes, these people, while they were doing these sort of, these are these big things I'm hoping to achieve, they're using things like insight and deception and, you know, all of those things off of their character sheet. Functionally speaking, they were all essentially luck rolls where the luck was skewed based on their competence in certain things and the characteristics of their character, right? You get a better chance of being lucky when you're good.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
So if you want to watch something that is a little bit outside of the box, I mentioned that I watched it in the wrong order because, again, The Ravening War is technically a prequel that you're supposed to watch after Crown of Candy because it kind of sets into motion those events. It is completely standalone in such that you don't need to watch Crown of Candy first or at all. It's 6 episodes, about 2 hours an episode, fairly charismatic cast. It was D&D done differently in a way that I haven't watched a lot of people do it. And I think there's certain aspects of that selectively that I'm going to want to sprinkle into how I run some games.
Well, I mean, it sounds interesting. And I look forward to listening to the recordings of your games that you do in these mini campaigns. I would like to say we do sort of, I think both of us have kind of burnt out on the Critical Role phenomenon. Which is unfortunate because there's a lot of talent involved in it, and I think they do a really good job. And if you enjoy it, you should watch it. I mean, give it a try. It might be your cup of tea. I would suggest if you're going to try it, start with Campaign 2 and skip Campaign 1 entirely. Or if you're going to do Campaign 1, start halfway through.
Yeah, in my case, I didn't even get a chance to burn out on it because I was so late coming to it. I was into other shows before Critical Role was even a thing. And I wanted to watch Critical Role back when it was initially launched on Geek and Sundry, but the production value of the initial stuff was so terrible. And that's fine. Like, I don't need high production value for everything, but like having a hard time even hearing them when they're sharing a single mic. And I get it. They didn't have any money at that point in time. The fact that they, you know, managed to push through that to where they are now, absolutely amazing.
Speaking, like you're talking about mini campaigns and enjoying that a bit more, I would suggest that you might want to look at Deadwood, which I think has like 12 episodes. And it's Matt Mercer plays in that one rather than DMing. And it works. I think he does anyway. It works out a little bit differently. I would also suggest anyone who hasn't seen Critical Role and wants to see a showcase of their talent, watch their live one shots.
Yes.
Because yeah. they're silly and they're fun, and it it sort of highlights just exactly how little editing happens in their role playing.
Yeah, you don't get much out of the story in them. Like, no. You know, because it's a one shot. You kind of have to be in the know for a lot of what's going on to have any meaning to you, but it's still enjoyable if you're not in the know.
I mean, in the first one, they fought a rubber duck as the final boss. Sorry, spoilers. But it's fantastic.
Yeah, I think, what's the one that I watched? I think I've only watched a couple of them. I can't remember. It was one that you recommended. It was Darrington Brigade, probably, or something like that. Mm. But yeah, for me, it was just, you know, there's just so much of it out there. Like, it's not the kind of thing that you can come to and be like, okay, I'm going to start at episode one. And like, I tried to get into Mighty Nine. Tanya and I were watching Mighty Nine. I think we got like 6 or 7 episodes in. I maybe picked up a couple, and it's just like, wow, I've invested 60 hours into this and I have 200 episodes to go for this campaign. And I've watched some longer campaign stuff. Like, I cut my teeth on Acquisitions Incorporated stuff. Ack Inc. The C-Team, still one of my favorite actual plays. It probably ran a little bit longer than it needed to. Sort of a different beast from the Critical Role stuff. But, you know, it's not a knock against it. Like, if it was the only thing I watched as an entertainment form, which I think for a lot of Critical Role fans is the case, then probably, I'm sure it's fine. Like, it's probably the exactly enough material, right?
It's totally fine. I think probably if you started, like, if they started another campaign and I was cognizant enough of local or current events to start as they were doing it. So I was like, yeah, okay, if I miss a week, it's no big deal because I can catch up. I might get into it because I do really enjoy all of their improvisation.
Oh,
I enjoy Matt Mercer as a DM. It's a mountain. You have to climb the mountain.
I think the only way I could honestly have time to consume it is if I wasn't actively running and playing in Dungeons & Dragons games, right?
Yeah.
And exactly. That's probably a big part of their fan base.
I would guess so. I mean, some of it probably is people who play a lot of D&D, and it's like, D&D is my life. This is my hobby.
Yeah.
Right? And that's fine. And for me, it's nowadays, I mean, right now, I'm going to do it maybe once every 6 weeks or so. Speaking of, I have some ideas for our campaign and how it's going to go forward, and I'm not going to tell you about them.
Is one of those ideas having the availability to play any possible other day except the weekend in the summer?
That's a possibility. I think though it's actually Chris's availability that we're working around, and I think he's probably only available Sunday evenings.
That's what killed the games that I was running too. It's like, we can only play Saturdays between this time and this time. It's like, man, that's the weekend in the summer. Like, what are the odds that 5 people are going to all have that off consistently?
Sunday evenings are the best bet for the weekend, I think.
Yeah.
So I have something to, are we largely at the end of our table talk?
Yeah, man.
Cool. I have some unrelated things that I'd like to say. First of all, I have a joke. So Twitter used to be called Twitter and is now in theory called X. I don't care. I've never been a member. But a lot of people are referring to it as replacing the TW with an X. So it becomes like X-itter. There's a bunch of languages where if you have X as the first letter, it has a sh sound. So I have started calling it shitter. Not super funny, but I thought it was amusing. I mildly, amusedly smirked.
I saw something to the effect today as a tweet. I don't know if it's legit or not, but it was coming from multiple sources saying that Twitter was just going to announce that adult content was fine. So instead of dealing with all of these porn bots, we're just going to make it totally okay now.
So what you're saying is that shitter is going to actually go down the shitter with just Nazi posts and porn?
Well, they're just going to add 2 more X's. That's all.
I also have a specific troll or, you know, dredge or whatever for Musk. Everything special about him came out of his daddy's wallet.
Did you work on those all week? Or?
No, they popped into my head like this morning.
And you've had them bottled up this long, eh?
I mean, I wrote them down. I refined them. I changed some wording around. Listen, I'm not a comedian. My delivery sucks. I'm aware of that. I'm much more of what's the thing you do with comedians when you're in the audience and you say shit?
Heckle.
So heckle. I'm much more of a heckler than I am a comedian. And I'm not even good at that. So anyway. These are the jokes, folks.
Do you have anything else, or do you want to tell me about this Davey 504 guy?
I want to talk about parting gifts. I have a parting gift.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Anybody want a peanut?
So the YouTube algorithm is evil. I think we established that previously, or if not, I'm going to continue to state it. But occasionally from the pile of excrement that is my feed on YouTube, a little nugget of gold pops up. I do not play the bass. I don't play the guitar particularly well, but I do appreciate music. So this guy, Davey 504, and he certainly does not need our support. He has 13.4 million subscribers, right? I think it's probably what he does for a living, and he deserves to have that many subscribers. He is really, really good. Like, he's a fantastic bass player. And he does a whole bunch of sort of weird stuff where he goes on Fiverr, which I'm not really familiar with, but I think it's kind of like a gig thing. And he'll do like, give me an impossible to play bass line, and then he'll play it back, right? Or do riffs on it or do a jam with it. He'll do like bass battles and stuff like that. But his delivery of content is absolutely perfect for the YouTube platform, where it's short, it's quick, it's fun, and it sort of highlights just exactly why YouTube is an awesome thing in spite of all of its evil. Because he does not enunciate super clearly. Like, English, I don't think is his first language. I think he's Italian, but I'm not sure. He's not conventionally handsome. So in sort of traditional media, he wouldn't be successful. Mm-hmm. And on Twitter, or on, not on Twitter, on YouTube, he is, and he deserves to be, because he's immensely talented. He has jump cuts in exactly the right places. There's multiple times that he's done things that is, like, absolutely, you know, it's the thing that everybody does, but he does it so well, it makes me chuckle. Right? And then he'll highlight a whole bunch of people who are playing bass. Here's someone who's posted a video, you know, we're going to go search Thailand bassists, and he'll go through them all, and he'll go, here's a really good one, and here's, I'm going to play it. And then he'll challenge somebody, and he'll send them a riff, and they'll send him something back, and they'll like trade the thing back and forth and create a jam out of it. And it's just like, it's just really engaging and entertaining to watch.
So here's a sort of related tangent. Related to the YouTube algorithm and whether it's evil and potentially sentient or not. Maybe correlation, maybe causation. My YouTube feed for the last, I'm going to say maybe 2.5 weeks, ballpark. Especially the shorts part of my YouTube feed. And I usually don't, you know, look at my algorithmically driven shit. I normally look at my subscriber feed, watch that, and sort of organically find new people. But occasionally I'll take a peek over there. About 2.5 weeks, it has been full of random shorts for bass players.
Really?
So the question is the algorithm selecting people, selecting these videos for people like you and I because we have common interests? Or am I seeing this shit because you've been watching it?
I'm not sure. I think it most likely popped up in my feed because I subscribe to Candy Rat Records. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but there's a couple of guys from the Quinny area who actually signed by them. And it's all that sort of percussive, like one guitar with like tapping and plucking with two hands kind of deal. Mm-hmm. So I watch a bit of that, and I do watch some musical stuff.
So am I being served up this content because you on your account, which is not connected to mine, except for the fact that we both have admin rights on a couple of YouTube channels, am I getting this shit because you're watching it?
Probably. I would suggest so.
Important follow-up question then.
Yeah. No, I haven't been watching YouTube porn
audience.
So that's you.
What should I be watching for the next couple weeks so that I can pollute Telson's YouTube feed with utter garbage? Submit your suggestions at podcast@nerdingundertheinfluence.com. We'll get the fruity goat porn in there for you somewhere.
Oh my! I saw somebody the other day posting on Reddit asking what goat SE was. So apparently that site has now come down.
Oh.
And some of the responses were absolute gold. if you don't know what it is, turn off your safe search filter and Google it. GoatSE.cx. Don't do that. Absolutely do not Google that. You will be scarred for life.
While you're at it, look up Two Girls, One Cup.
Oh my God, or Tub Girl.